So if you recall, last week we had just left off with the story of Joseph having been sold by his jealous brothers into Egypt and was carried down to that place and sold into the home of Potiphar. And he served there faithfully, effectively, for about 10 years. And then at the end of that, when he's turning about 27 years old, it's at that point that he is framed by Potiphar's ne'er-do-well wife, as you recall. And as a result of that, he's thrown into prison. So we've had about 10 years now that have elapsed, and it brings us to the story that's before us this morning, which starts in Genesis chapter 40, beginning at verse 1. I did mention to you last week that I wanted to just say a word about this chapter that we skipped over, which is chapter 38. It's an odd story. It's there for a purpose. I'm not going through it. I just want to mention it so it isn't just completely ignored here. But it's the story of Judah. In some ways, it appears that the author here is trying to set up Joseph and Judah almost as kind of counterpoint, contrarieties to each other. Joseph was so insulted. Hey, guys, these two sons, see, there we are, these sons are said to be so wicked that God actually slays them. And the impression is from the text that they were slain not simply out of the blue, like by a lightning bolt or something, but as a fair reprisal for the wicked lives that they were pursuing. In other words, a kind of self-destructive behavior brought about their demise. But the death of these two left then Judah with this daughter-in-law, who had been married by the first son, and her name is Tamar. And the custom at that time was that when a son died and there was a surviving daughter-in-law, that the father, the father-in-law, should provide to her another son from the same family to raise up seed to the deceased son. You're familiar with that. Well, Judah failed of that responsibility. I'm not going to go into all the sordid details here. You can read it for yourself. But Judah, for whatever reasons, was not fulfilling that responsibility. And Tamar there engages in a deception, playing the role of a prostitute, and actually has relations with Judah himself. And there is a child born of that relationship, and that child actually becomes one of the children in the lineage of Christ, interestingly enough. So Tamar is actually mentioned in Matthew in his genealogy of Christ. Part of the purpose of the story itself seems to be to set up within the same family such stark contrasts of character. And we have Joseph on the one hand, who distinguishes himself in every respect as a godly individual, and then you have, on the other hand, a Judah who seems to just go pell-mell in the other direction, and yet, strangely enough, it's out of the line of Judah that Christ himself is born, and that becomes the ruling tribe in Israel. Well, that whole story spans a considerable period of time. As you can tell, it would go on for several years. There's hardly any other convenient place to put it in the story, so it's inserted there between chapters 37 and 39. I think the principal thing we gain from it is simply not only a commentary on our own capacity to mess up our lives, you know, that's certainly part of the story, but also to say that Christ is certainly human. The classical creeds of the church affirm the true deity and the true humanity of Christ. And there's no apology in Matthew or the other genealogies of Christ for the embarrassing details of his lineage. And this is one of those embarrassing details. Jesus was certainly exempted from the sinfulness of that. We're getting a tightly started great story. And it doesn't take a whole lot of comment from me. You know, it's just wonderfully self-explanatory. So I'll try not to get in the way this morning. We'll just listen to the drama as it unfolds. Here we are, Genesis chapter 40, beginning at verse 1. Let's have a word of prayer and then we'll get underway. Father, we're grateful for your constant grace to us, the mercy that is new each day. We thank you for the privilege that's ours to once again reflect on this remarkable life of Joseph, the way that you blessed him and blessed through him. We pray that our continued reflection on his drama would serve to encourage each of us as well. We give you thanks in the name of Christ. Amen. Verse 1, sometime after this is, by the way, after now Joseph has been put in prison. So we're just picking up where we left off. Sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in the custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he waited on them. And they continued for some time in custody. One night they both dreamed, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own meaning. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in custody in the master's house, "Why are your faces downcast today?" They said to him, "We have had dreams, and there's no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." So again, we're thrust into a wonderful story here. Let's just pick up a couple of details before we move on. When it says sometime after this, by the chronology that we can piece together from other texts, we know that it had only been a few months. Joseph was probably 27 when he was put into prison, and he's probably still in his 27th year, maybe just turned 28, but it's probably only been there about 6 months when these events take place. So he's not there for a protracted period of time yet. These two are submitted to the care of Joseph. They are the butler, or the cupbearer, as he's called here, and the baker. The cupbearer was a high official, usually a close confidant of the Pharaoh. His chief responsibility officially was to be a food taster. Now, this was partly to determine whether the food was appropriate to feed to the Pharaoh, but it was also to determine whether the food was poisoned, you see. So the cupbearer would take a little bite, and if he didn't turn white and keel over, then the Pharaoh would figure that food was safe to eat. But generally, this was a very trusted individual, someone that was part of the inner circle of the Pharaoh. This was common in the Near East. Egypt not only had this kind of official, but others did. You may recall Nehemiah later was a cupbearer to Artaxerxes, who was the king of Persia many years later. So it's kind of a standard role, but it's very high, very prestigious position. The other individual is the baker. He was responsible to prepare the food that would be eaten by Pharaoh and others in his family, and even to some extent to the court itself. Josephus tells us the reason that these two were thrown into prison was because there had been a conspiracy to poison the Pharaoh. Now, sometimes Josephus speculates a bit, and so we don't know for sure if that's correct, but apparently there's some likelihood that that may have been, in fact, what had happened here. But for some reason or other, Pharaoh becomes unhappy with both of these characters. He's probably taking time to sort out exactly what's going on, and in the meantime, he puts these two guys on ice there in the prison as he's going to take some time to sort out what's happened. So Pharaoh was angry with the two officers, the chief cupbearer, the chief baker. He put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison where Joseph was confined. Now, you may notice that the phrase that's used here, the captain of the guard, is the same phrase that was used to describe Potiphar. Back in chapter 39, verse 1, an official of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. The word for guard that's used here is a word that actually implies caring for a prison administration, like a warden, we might say. It may very well be that the reason that Potiphar could so summarily put Joseph in prison was because Potiphar himself was over the prison. That's at least strongly implied by the text. It therefore means that Potiphar may still have been the one that Joseph was working for. That implies that Potiphar may have actually known that Joseph was framed. And many commentators actually believe that's the case. Potiphar knew that his wife, he knew his wife well, and he knew that she was probably capable of this kind of misdirected accusation. In fact, Egyptian women of that day were somewhat notorious for their promiscuity, and Potiphar probably had some idea that this was not Joseph's, principal fault here. And so to protect domestic tranquility, rather than reacting to his wife, he simply deals with Joseph separately, puts him in prison. But it doesn't take long for Joseph to once again be elevated to some kind of status of responsibility there. Now, again, I'm on highly speculative grounds, but I just want you to know at least some good commentators think that's going on. I personally think that may be exactly what's happening. So it may still be Potiphar who is overseeing some of these things, although he's never named expressly again in the text. In any event, here he is serving, and now, as it turns out, he starts doing service to these two Egyptian servants of Pharaoh. The captain of the guard, verse 4, charged Joseph with them, and he waited on them, and they continued for some time in custody. He's waiting on them as in being a waiter, caring for their needs. These two guys were white-collar criminals. Some people go to federal front, you've heard of Club Med, some go to Club Fed, you've heard that expression. That's kind of where these guys were, Club Fed. They were probably getting better than your average treatment here, because even though they were in prison, they were nevertheless people of some prominence. And so Joseph is assigned to their care and is probably discharging those duties in a very responsible fashion. Verse 5, one night they both dreamed, the cupbearer and the baker, both of them in the same night having an impressive, vivid dream. The providence of God, of course, very evident here, that both of them in the same night would have this dream that leaves such an impression upon them. Had either of them had a dream, it might not have been quite as significant, but the fact that both of them wake up in the morning distressed in a dream, and then as soon as they talk, they realize the other one had a dream. And this just strikes them as something that must be very significant. And they're musing, turning over, what could these dreams mean? And they're trying to figure it out. And then Joseph, verse 6, comes walking in and sees them in this perplexity. It says a lot about Joseph, doesn't it? I have to say, honestly, if I had been Joseph, I would have been so upset, so engulfed in self-pity over my own unhappy circumstances, I probably would have been completely oblivious to the needs or concerns of anybody around me. But here's Joseph, in spite of the abuse that he has taken, nevertheless so aware of those that he's dealing with that he immediately spots something's up, something's going on. And it just shows something of Joseph's own detachment from his own unhappy circumstances, that he can still be thinking of others and their welfare. That's a very Christian thing, isn't it? A very godly thing that we find here in this remarkable young man. So he walks in, he sees that they're troubled, he inquires thoughtfully, what's the problem, guys? What's up? And, of course, they begin to explain to him the circumstances of this dream that they've each had and wondering what it could mean. They, of course, are inclined to attach great significance to dreams. Joseph immediately gives credit to God, not holding himself out as any sort of soothsayer himself. He just asserts, right off the bat that any of this sort of thing has to come from God, and then invites that they would tell him the dream. So, verse 9. So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream there was a vine before me, and on the vine there were three branches. As soon as it budded, its blossoms came out, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." So the dream, at least on its face, sounds positive. The butler had to have been somewhat encouraged just at the general feel of this dream. Wine, by the way, was very rare in Egypt at that time. Herodotus tells us that the common people could not afford wine. It was only available to the most wealthy people, the Pharaoh, the courtesans of Pharaoh, and certain people that had very either wealthy or prominent positions had this great luxury of drinking wine. So the fact that the butler is seen as pouring wine into the cup of Pharaoh, and indeed would again give an impression that this is a fairly positive dream, whatever the interpretation of it seems. Verse 12, Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand, just as you used to do when you were his cupbearer. But do me the kindness to make mention of me to Pharaoh. So get out of this. I was here out of the land of the Hebrews." He's gushing, you know. And he says, "I was stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I've done nothing that I should have been put into this dungeon." So poor Joseph, he gives the proper understanding of the dream, but he's not above seizing the opportunity to plead with this high official that when he's back in the service of Pharaoh, he might just drop a word. "Oh, by the way, Pharaoh, I ran into a remarkable guy there in the prison. He probably shouldn't be there. In fact, he interpreted a dream." Anything like that. Some people have actually been critical of Joseph. Some of the commentators say, you know, Joseph shouldn't have done this. This was really beneath his dignity. He should have just simply given the interpretation and left it at that, trusted God. But I don't think so. I don't find any fault at all here with what Joseph does, sort of grabbing this moment to lobby for his own interests. Paul makes a great comment in the New Testament. He says, "I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. I have learned in whatsoever condition I am, therewith to be content." And there is a very Christian quality in the life of faith of being content. Life sometimes deals us difficult circumstances. It's not always, you know, as Forrest Gump would say, a box of cherries or whatever. It's not always that way. Sometimes it's difficult, but there is a learning to be content, which is part of a godly character. But there's nothing wrong, even in the context of that contentment, in which we're not grousing and, you know, complaining and bemoaning our circumstance, to still seek an improvement if we can do so in a legitimate way. That's all right. We're not just, you know, to necessarily just wind up in a kind of passive paralysis. We can make a move. We can do something as long as we're not breaking the rules of Christian character and integrity. Here, Joseph seizes that opportunity. Paul had a thorn in the flesh. He prayed 3 times that God would remove it from him. God said no on that occasion. But, you know, Paul still was okay to be asking. It wasn't a wrong thing to do. Joseph does the same thing here. So it's good practical self-help ethics going on, and I don't see any problem. I think we'll just leave it at that. So verse 16, then the other dream is announced, verse 16. When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph, "I also had a dream. There were 3 cake baskets on my head. And in the uppermost basket, there were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating it out of the basket on my head." Doesn't sound quite like as good a dream, does it? I mean, again, if we didn't even know the meaning, we would sort of go, that has a little bit more of a little uneasy sense as to what exactly might be going on there. Joseph, of course, has this divine inspiration, we can assume, as to its precise meaning. And he must have been moved, I would say, to have to tell the baker this the meaning of the dream. But Joseph also knew that integrity demanded that he not vary a hair's breadth from the absolute truth of the matter. And so with a kind of straightforward truthfulness, he tells the baker, "Well, here's the way it is." Verse 18, "And Joseph answered, 'This is the interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a pole, and the birds will eat the flesh from you.'" Not quite as nice a dream. So they both were going to have their heads lifted up, but in quite 2 different senses. Josephus tells us that indeed it was the baker who was a conspirator to poison the Pharaoh. The butler was, free from guilt. Again, what Josephus' sources may have been is an open question, but that's his view of it. How exactly the baker was put to death is an open question. Perhaps he was decapitated and his head was actually literally lifted from him. Most people think he was hung, and indeed the text later will suggest that he was in fact hung. But be that as it may, the two dreams are given, the interpretations are given, going on from there at verse 20. On the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his place of cupbearing, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But the chief baker he hanged, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. You think, now how could he do that? I mean, come on, man. You know, this is a fairly bright guy. How can you just forget something that is so dramatic as this? The likelihood is here that the cupbearer did not actually forget in the sense that this memory faded into oblivion. It was probably more on the cupbearer's part something of tactical prudence. The cupbearer was very happy to be back in the service of Pharaoh, restored to his prominent position. He probably was loath to remind Pharaoh that only recently he'd been in prison. Only recently he'd been suspected of great capital criminal conduct. He probably wanted to have Pharaoh forget that unhappy chapter, and he himself wanted to forget that unhappy chapter, and unfortunately part of the unhappy chapter was Joseph. And so Joseph is lost in this kind of forgetfulness, as it were, on the part of the butler. But obviously he didn't forget it utterly, because later it will come back to his mind in a different setting. But here we are now, 2 years later, chapter 41. After 2 whole years, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile. And there came out of the Nile 7 sleek and fat cows, and they grazed in the reed grass. Then 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. The ugly and thin cows ate up the 7 sleek and fat cows, and Pharaoh awoke. Then he fell asleep and dreamed a second time. 7 ears of grain, plump and good, were growing on one stalk. Then 7 ears, thin and blighted by the east wind, sprouted after them. The thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump and full ears. Pharaoh awoke, and it was a dream. In the morning his spirit was troubled, so he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all his wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. So 2 years have passed, and we happen to know, we'll find out later in the chapter, that Joseph is now just 30 years old. So 2 years from his probably 28, 29, 30 brings us to this moment. The year, by the way, is 1670 B.C., Pharaoh dreams that he's standing by the Nile. The dream, of course, would be very significant with any reference to the Nile. The Nile was virtually worshipped by the Egyptians. It was the source of their life. Herodotus calls Egypt the gift of the Nile. The Nile created Egypt, particularly Lower Egypt, where these things are happening, the Delta region. Egypt got very little rainfall, but every year the Nile would overflow its banks and water that entire region, so it was quite lush and fertile, and it was something of the breadbasket of the ancient world. Somewhat famine-proof, really, in many ways, because the Nile would tend to overflow even when there were famine conditions elsewhere. The Nile was extraordinarily important. Pharaoh dreams of the Nile, and then as he's watching the Nile, out of it come 7 sleek and fat cows. The Egyptians also worshipped cows. So we have 2 of the Egyptian deities, as it were, playing in this dream. The Apis bull was another of the important objects of worship among the Egyptians. You may remember the children of Israel, when they left Egypt in the Exodus, crafted a golden calf, which was in fact in celebration of the Egyptian gods that it resembled bovine creatures, such as bulls and cows. And so anyway, this is very impressive now for Pharaoh, to have the Nile, to have these cows and so on. They're sleek, they're powerful, they're well-fed. It all sounds like a wonderful situation that's being presented to Pharaoh's consciousness. However, things change a bit. The seven other cows are ugly and thin. They come up out of the Nile. See, nothing about that is very good. The Nile producing these ugly, gaunt, starved cows. And they stood by the other ones on the bank, and then the ugly ones eat the sleek cows. And then it says Pharaoh awoke, probably in a cold sweat, you see. This was not a pretty picture. He didn't know quite what it meant, but he knew it didn't look good. The events of this dream troubled him, to say the least. He fell asleep again, and then a similar kind of dream. He saw seven ears of grain. Egypt, as I say, was something of the breadbasket of the ancient world during that time, and indeed throughout ancient history, even up to the time of the Apostle Paul, Egypt was famous for its grain exports. In fact, when Paul was traveling from Israel to Rome on the last of his journeys, the ship he was on was an Egyptian grain ferry. And they threw the grain overboard, you recall, when they got caught in the storm. So Egypt was famous for its grain, and even at this time in history, that was the case. And so again, Pharaoh sees something that says to him, this is the greatness of Egypt that's being brought before my eyes. But then, of course, verse 6, seven ears thin and blighted by the east wind sprouted after them. The east wind would blow in off the Sinai, but just wither everything in its path. One of the threats at that time, in this sense, then another very negative kind of image that Pharaoh has presented to him. The thin ears swallowed up the seven plump ones. Pharaoh awoke. It was a dream. In the morning, of course, he's very distressed about this. He calls for his wise men. Can't you tell me the meaning of this? The wise men are reticent to do so, because these dreams seem to imply events of the future. And if a wise man should presume to interpret a dream incorrectly, then the wise man himself might pay a very heavy price, up to and including death. And so these wise men, exercising a certain degree of caution, are going, Pharaoh, not too sure what to make of that. Very interesting. And they're kind of just standing back and not committing themselves here. Well, then, of course, the chief cupbearer, this jogs his memory, in the house of the captain of the guard, drunk night, with a meaning. A young Hebrew was there, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving us an interpretation to each according to his dream. As he interpreted to us, so it turned out. I was restored to my office, the baker was hanged. So here now, this circumstance of Joseph's, or of Pharaoh's dream, jogs the memory. The butler seizes the opportunity, probably seeing at this point now that something good may come of this, that this is going to be a good development, not only for Pharaoh, but possibly even for the butler himself. So continuing from there, then verse 14. Then Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was hurriedly brought out of the dungeon. When he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not I. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, in my dream I was standing on the banks of the Nile, and seven cows, fat and sleek, came up out of the Nile and fed in the reed grass. Then seven other cows came up after them, poor, very ugly and thin. Never had I seen such ugly ones in all the land of Egypt. The thin and ugly cows ate up the first seven fat cows. And when they had eaten them, no one would have known that they had done so, for they were still as ugly as before. Then I awoke. I fell asleep a second time, and I saw in my dream seven ears of grain, full and good, growing on one stalk. and 7 ears withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind sprouting after them. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 good ears. But when I told it to the magicians, there was no one who could explain it to me. So here is Joseph now before the Pharaoh. Let's pick up a couple of details. Back in verse 14, when Pharaoh sent for Joseph, he came hurriedly from the dungeon. The word in Hebrew there that's translated hurriedly is actually the word that means running. He came running from the dungeons, you see. So not only was the urgency from Pharaoh, but the motivation from Joseph combined here for a very rapid escape then from those unhappy digs. And then it said, which would have grown there in prison, but also of the hair. You may know that the Egyptians customarily, especially high officials and priests, would shave their entire head of all hair. And in fact, many of the pharaohs, of course, would wear these headdresses, but underneath they were bald because they'd been shaven of their hair. And so probably to properly present himself before this pharaoh, Joseph himself is fully shaved, his entire head and face and so on. And I might just mention in passing here, this is a little footnote to this whole discussion. When we ask the question, what pharaoh was this? It's not altogether clear, but it's pretty clear the general time frame. This is part of that so-called 15th dynasty in Egypt that was called the Hyksos, H-Y-K-S-O-S. It's a very interesting and intriguing aspect of Egyptian history that all through its history, there were naysayers about where come, no, there was something obvious. The case is obviously speculative, but that the timing would put it right in the middle of the Hyksos dynasties is quite well established. So that at least is an interesting side note. Here comes Joseph now in front of this pharaoh, properly groomed now and ready to meet him. And what we have then is a recitation of the dream that's provided to him. Let me just... Joseph gives credit to God. That's the only thing I wanted to mention here again. Joseph, of course, giving ready acknowledgement that it's God's doing to provide this interpretation to him. The dream itself is recited. I won't go through that again. It virtually is identical to what we've heard. But two little editorial remarks from Pharaoh, I think, are interesting. The first one in verse 19, never had I seen such ugly ones in all the land of Egypt, you know. Pharaoh had seen a lot of cows, but these took the cake. And the other one was in verse 21, when these cows had eaten up the fat cows, you couldn't tell any difference, you know. You would have thought the thin ones would have fattened up a little bit, but no, they looked just as grim as they had before. So that's Pharaoh's additional comments on the circumstances. Then Joseph, Pharaoh's dream, God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good ears are 7 years. The dreams are 1. The 7 lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, as are the 7 empty ears blighted by the east wind. They are 7 years of famine. It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. There will be 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. After them will come 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land. The plenty will no longer be known in the land because of the famine that will follow. It will be very grievous. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God. God will shortly bring it about. So Joseph here has given then a very precise interpretation, obviously under divine inspiration once again, of the meaning of those dreams. Joseph is not just speculating at this point, but obviously is saying these things because it is being, in some sense or other, somehow or other, communicated to him from the very divine source of God himself. I don't know that much needs to be said about it. The interpretation is pretty straightforward and discernible without any further comment from me. But let's pick up at verse 33. Joseph now gives advice, counsel to Pharaoh in light of this impending set of circumstances. Verse 33. Now therefore let Pharaoh select a man who is discerning and wise and set him over the land of Egypt. let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the seven plenteous years. Let them gather all the food of these years that are coming and lay up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to befall the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine. So Joseph now at this point proposes that Pharaoh should select somebody, just anybody. You can kind of see. What's in Joseph's mind here. I imagine he thought to himself, maybe, who knows, you know, this could be my day. What a difference a day can make. But Joseph proposes then that Pharaoh should select somebody and put them in this prominent position. Obviously, what Joseph was thinking was just somebody over the administration of this project of gathering grain during the 7 years of plenty and then storing it up against the 7 years of famine. I don't think he probably anticipated that Pharaoh would even actually outdo him in his own proposition. But Pharaoh takes up Joseph's request and even goes a step further, as we see then in, beginning in verse 37. The proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find anyone else like this, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, and there is no one so discerning and wise as you, you will be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only with regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over the land of Egypt." Removing his signet ring from his hand, Pharaoh put it on Joseph's hand. He arrayed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in the chariot of his second in command, and they cried out in front of him, "Bow the knee." Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and he gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as his wife. Thus Joseph gained authority over the land of Egypt. So we have this remarkable, then, elevation of Joseph. One day, he's been unshaven in the prison, a mere servant of prisoners. And the next day, he is, as they call it, the vizier, or the prime minister, the second in command to Pharaoh himself. We know that in Egypt especially, they had such an office. The so-called vizier was the second person behind Pharaoh in authority. I don't know who got bumped so that Joseph could be placed in that position. But this was a known office, and he's given all of the accoutrements of that office, including the signet ring, which did exist. In fact, they've actually excavated examples of signet rings from various times in Egyptian history, meaning that Joseph himself could, in a sense, speak with the authority of Pharaoh himself. It's just a remarkable elevation of status for Joseph here. He's given a name, first of all, which is hard to pronounce, Zaphnath-Paaneah. There's some speculation as to what that name means. It's not real easy to interpret, but it seems at least to have some idea of savior. Savior of the land, savior of the people, something like that. So the name itself that's given to Joseph certainly celebrates what Pharaoh perceived to be the significance of Joseph, that he was one who was bringing salvation, at least in a material sense, to these Egyptians. He's also given a wife from the priest of On. The city of On was also called Heliopolis. It was a major center of worship in Egypt. This would be, therefore, a pagan priest and presumably a pagan daughter who's being given to Joseph as his wife. Some have criticized Joseph, saying that at this point Joseph should have declined to marry a pagan. And so people that are trying to find fault with Joseph wherever they can will seize on that and say this represented a bit of a lapse on Joseph's part. I think the better opinion is that that was not at all the case. God would sometimes sanction, not typically, but in some cases, a marriage such as this one. The most famous example of that would be, for example, Esther, who marries Xerxes, who was by no means a believer in the Hebrew God, you know, but that was obviously a marriage sanctioned by God, and God raised up Esther, as it were, for such a time as this, using that language there in Esther, and so there was no judgment of God or critique of Esther at that point for marrying Xerxes, even though he was a pagan. It doesn't happen often, but there are times when you might find, on a rare occasion, as it were, a diplomatic marriage that would be sanctioned by God. It may also be, now this is speculation, that the wife of Joseph came to be a believer. It's hard to believe she wouldn't have been impressed with Joseph and impressed with the evidence of God's grace in his life. And so for all we know, she may, by the time had passed, come to embrace the God that Joseph worshipped. All right, let's move on. We're just running out of time quickly here. Joseph 46, verse 46. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. During the 7 plenteous years, the earth produced abundantly. He gathered up all the food of the 7 years when there was plenty in the land of Egypt and stored up the food in the cities. He stored up in every city the food from the fields around it. So Joseph stored up grain in such abundance, like the sand of the sea, that he stopped measuring it. It was beyond measure. So for 7 years, you've got abundant produce, and Joseph manages well then this storage against the coming years. Verse 50, before the years of famine came, Joseph had 2 sons, whom Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardships in my father's house. The word Manasseh means forgetting. The second he named Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my misfortunes. Ephraim means fruitful. As you probably are aware, both Manasseh and Ephraim are going to be elevated by Jacob later in this book to become not simply sons of a patriarch, but patriarchs themselves. Each of them becomes a tribe among the tribes of Israel, which takes place right at the end. All right, let's just quickly get in this last paragraph and we will have made it. Verse 53, the 7 years of plenty that prevailed in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in every country, but throughout the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Pharaoh said to the Egyptians, go to Joseph. What he says to you, do. And since the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the world came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine became severe throughout the world. And this, of course, sets us up now for the most remarkable part of this story, which is where the ne'er-do-well brothers of Joseph himself are going to find themselves before this brother. But we'll save that. Got about a minute.